Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Sarah Cash presents a brief history of Hiram Power's marble sculpture, The Greek Slave, at the second annual John Wilmerding Symposium on American Art, held on March 23, 2018, at the National Gallery of Art. In particular, Cash considers the work's changing display and reception, both public and private, in Washington, D.C. from 1848 onward. The John Wilmerding Symposium on American Art is made possible by a grant from the Walton Family Foundation.
Good morning. Last month at this podium, Carrie Mae Weems spoke powerfully on a wide range of ideas, one of which in particular resonated with my thinking about the Greek slave. The artist remarked that after she completes her works, they no longer belong to her, but rather, quote, to those people who engage them, end quote. Each object, she said, has, quote, another life of its own that the viewer, the audience, needs to negotiate. Countless viewers have engaged with, have negotiated, the National Gallery's Greek Slave over its nearly 180-year history. Soon after it left Hiram Power's studio in Florence, Italy, it was exhibited in 8 U.S. cities, owned by a succession of 4 individuals, and later by 2 art museums. The peripatetic sculpture has forged connections with, and often between, its audiences across a vast spectrum of time and space. This has made it, to quote scholar Jennifer Roberts, about Roberts' words about another work of art, quote, a space binder, end quote. A space binder that, quote, powerfully shaped human subjectivity and activity, end quote. As Hiram Power's friend and promoter Minor Kellogg remarked about the sculpture when it arrived in the United States in 1847, quote, the statue of the Greek slave is here. Let our countrymen now tell the rest of the story. In the first part of my talk this morning, as a preface to the 2 subsequent ones, I will introduce the sculpture and its context in Power's oeuvre. In the second part, I'll focus on the marble's time in Washington, both briefly in 1848 and then from 1851 to the present. I will consider its impact on those who viewed it, purchased it, sold it, exhibited it, designed spaces for it, and more. Conversely, I will investigate how the sculpture's travels and displays contribute to our understanding of the work and its place in our country's and this city's history. In my preparations, I've been aided by the work of many scholars, some of whom are present today. I thank them. Hiram Powers and his assistants in Florence carved the Greek slave entirely by hand from marble quarried at Serravezza in Tuscany. The full-length nude figure represents a woman captured by the Turks during the Greek War of Independence, which occurred in the 1820s. Chained at the wrists, she awaits her sale into slavery. Her relaxed arms and averted gaze suggest her modesty and resignation to her fate. While the sculpture no longer retains its original pedestal, that included a mechanism to allow the sculpture to rotate. Almost hidden in her discarded clothing, draped on a pillar, is a Phrygian cap, as you can see in the detail at the right. Below the cap hangs a Latin cross and a locket with a Greek cross, which convey that the slave is a Christian, and, according to a pamphlet about which we will soon hear more, that she is, quote, a being superior to suffering and raised above degradation by inward purity and force of character, end quote. As a young man in Cincinnati, Vermont-born Hiram Powers progressed from modeling lifelike wax figures, so lifelike that women are said to have fainted, to sculpting in stone in the prevailing neoclassical style. His great Cincinnati patron, Speaker of the House, our house here in Washington, Nicholas Longworth, sponsored the artist's stay in Washington, D.C. from 1834 to 1837. Here, the artist received many commissions to portray famous statesmen, most notably Andrew Jackson, as you can see on the screen, and was praised for his sculpture's realism. And so begins the Washington intrigue, to which we will later return. Hiram Power selected the locations of his studios with care, after maintaining one in the Capitol building, not uncommon in the 19th century, interestingly, he then rented a studio at 4th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, just a crosswalk away from this building where John Marshall Park and its surrounding courthouses now stand. Everyone, that is every potential patron, passed Hiram Powers' door on the way to or from the Capitol or the White House. Conveniently, the editor of a leading Washington newspaper worked in the same building. Soon, regular notices appeared in that paper about the sculptor's new works and activities. In 1837, Powers settled in Florence to study great European works of art and to have access to Italian quarries and stone cutters. Because of his talent in carving both realistic renderings and idealized neoclassical works so popular at the time, Powers became one of the most successful and highly regarded sculptors of the 19th century. Here things get a tiny bit confusing. After completing his first Greek slave, and I will speak about works from left to right. After completing his first Greek slave in 1844, Powers produced 5 full-size marble versions, each slightly different. The National Gallery marble was the first of these, second from left, and was ordered from Powers by the British nobleman William Ward, but released by him prior to its completion, apparently because some desired alterations were not realized. The other 3 extant marbles are in Newark, New Haven, and Brooklyn, as you can see here. The event that established Powers' reputation, as well as that of the Greek slave, as one of America's most celebrated works of art, arguably the most famous American sculpture ever, was the tour of 2 versions of the sculpture, including the National Gallery one, around the eastern United States from 1847 to 1851. As you can see in this map, we have the sculpture moving from Florence to New York to Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, New Orleans, Cincinnati, Cincinnati back to Washington, more about which in a few minutes. As the first publicly exhibited life-size American sculpture depicting a fully nude female figure, the work met with unprecedented popular and critical reception, both positive and negative. The tour occurred on the advice of Powers' friend and promoter, Minor Kellogg, seen at left, who promoted it with eye-catching advertisements, like the one you see on the right. Aware that the slave's nudity might provoke disapproval on the part of a conservative American audience, Kellogg and Powers were careful to supplement the exhibition tours with a brochure containing texts stressing the subject's, quote, high moral and intellectual beauty, end quote. Typical were the phrases highlighted here. The slave was, quote, clothed all over with sentiment, end quote. And from an oft-repeated poem, she was, quote, naked, yet clothed with chastity, she stands, end quote. The word genius is used no fewer than 7 times in the text of the brochure, and perfection is used at least 2. Without parallel appears frequently. You can see the promotion that was going on here. Powers' work is compared to that of Lysippus, Michelangelo, and Donatello, and Pliny the Elder's writings on antique sculpture are invoked. It's a lot to live up to. Naturally, the figure's nudity increased its notoriety, but the work's acclaim also stemmed from its relationship to contemporary political events in the United States. Despite Powers' assertion that the work was inspired by the Greek struggle for independence, many literary, artistic, and critical responses to the sculpture linked it to the ongoing debate over American slavery. I'm showing but 1 example. Tess Korobkin will take up this topic in greater detail. At the close of the traveling exhibition in Philadelphia in 1848, Powers sold the Greek slave to James Robb of New Orleans, seen at the left. Robb had made a down payment in 1845, but did not receive the work due to a complicated set of circumstances that I don't have time to go into at the moment. And throughout the sculpture's exhibition tour, Robb had become impatient to receive it. The Pennsylvania-born banker, railroad president, and art collector owned slaves, but was strongly anti-secession. And at the right, I'm showing you an image of the New Orleans slave market, also from the historic New Orleans collection. In 1848-49, Robb, in New Orleans, showed his prized new possession first in his home and then at a gallery called Cook's Gallery. As scholar Caitlin Beach has discovered, Robb installed a red flag outside the building housing the display of the sculpture, the precise type of red flag that publicized slave auctions in New Orleans and elsewhere. And you can see this remarkable flag just down the street at the National Museum of African American and Culture. Contemporaneous slave auctions are marked on the map at the right with a red dot. You can see that there are many, were many. And the blue star signifies the place where the Greek slave was displayed, again, also with this red flag. Despite Robb's obvious delight in possessing and displaying the sculpture, he soon sold it to the Western Art Union in Cincinnati, which in turn offered it amidst much publicity as its first lottery prize in early 1851. To the disappointment of residents of Powers' native Cincinnati, the Greek slave was won by a New Orleans subscriber, a hatter, James Darcy, a brother-in-law, coincidentally, I suppose, of James Robb. Although there was considerable interest in Darcy's future plans for the sculpture, he was said to have plans for an exhibition, and P.T. Barnum was rumored to be interested in acquiring it, the work was purchased almost immediately by Washington banker and art collector William Wilson Corcoran. We will come back to that. Also in 1851, the first version of the Greek slave was displayed as the centerpiece of the U.S. display at the Great Exhibition in London, otherwise known as the Crystal Palace Exhibition. This event not only won Powers international acclaim, but also greatly emphasized the overseas reputation of American art and culture. In Florence, Powers, riding high, was overwhelmed by the demand for more full-size versions, two-thirds scale versions, and busts. The sculpture's renown also permeated popular culture, inspiring everything from miniature reproductions, like the one you see at the far left, to chewing tobacco tins, to poetry and sheet music. I will now turn to the second part of my story, an examination of the sculpture's history in Washington, D.C. And it is truly a Washington story, complete with political intrigue, favors curried from the White House to the Capitol, jockeying for position, backroom promises, fancy weddings in art-filled rooms, and even a swamp and a wall. And all of this swirling around a revolving sculpture of a seemingly innocent young woman. In the fall of 1847, while what is now the gallery's Greek slave was drawing record crowds and income for Powers during its display in New York City, Powers' agent, Minor Kellogg, remember Powers was in Florence, so his agent, Minor Kellogg, was here in this country. Kellogg was in Washington negotiating what he and Powers hoped would be a permanent public home for the sculpture at the close of its East Coast tour. That home, Kellogg and Powers hoped, would be the as yet unbuilt Smithsonian Institution building, commissioned from the architect James Renwick, the building we now call the Castle, which was constructed between 1847 and 1855. Meeting with congressmen and other members of the Smithsonian Board of Regents, Kellogg proposed that the sculpture should be placed in a fireproof tribune in the largest of the building's north towers, facing what is now the Mall. This is a very big ambition. It was then called the Smithsonian Park. According to the plan, for 3 years, Powers would receive the admission fees from people coming to see the Greek slave in the tower, in the castle, after which time the sculpture would be owned outright by the Smithsonian. After nearly 2 years of negotiations, Kellogg and Powers were unable to place the sculpture with the government and decided to sell it to James Robb, as we've learned. Some parties strongly opposed exhibiting indefinitely a work of art by one sculptor. Among them was surely the Smithsonian's first secretary, Joseph Henry, who not only opposed the construction of the large and ornate building, but also cared little about museum displays, calling visitors to the art gallery idlers. By the way, because Henry did not want to waste money, as he said, on fireproofing this building, it partially burned in 1865. Christian newspapers joined the opposition to having the Greek slave on view in this building, calling the work and, quote, indecent sculpture for which government funds should not be prostituted, contending that the only hall, quote, the only hall worthy of it would be one in which there were neither doors nor windows, end quote. During this negotiation process in the late 1840s, Kellogg surely was aware of the proposed Smithsonian building's proximity to one of the largest slave markets in this country. In 1850, Smithsonian Regent Jefferson Davis remarked of William H. Williams' Yellow House, shown here at the top right, quote, it is the house by which all must go to reach the building of the Smithsonian Institution. The Yellow House was a two or three story brick dwelling covered with plaster, painted yellow, naturally, and within viewing distance of the Capitol. A 12-foot high wall encircled the structure, guarded by ferocious dogs. Nearby, Roby's slave pen, seen at the bottom right, also held slaves intended for auction. A 15-foot high wall surrounded these grounds. Transported from nearby areas, the slaves were subjected to brutal conditions before their sale and were marched through the streets of Washington in coffles, led by a trader with a whip, just outside this building, if you can imagine. Pens like these operated until the passage of the Compromise Act in 1850, although slave ownership continued. Hiram Powers must have seen these slave pens and coffles while in Washington in the late 1830s, before he went to Florence. On a single day, for example, in 1836, and Powers, by the way, lived somewhere in Southwest Washington and would have walked to his studio, as I mentioned, at 4th and Pennsylvania, up here. One day in 1836, 1,200 slaves were offered for sale by three traders. This lends a different inflection to Powers' later statement about the proposed Smithsonian site for his masterpiece, I think. Powers wrote to Kellogg, "It will not be the first tower for a slave, but there is something distressing in the idea of solitary confinement in a tower, and therefore, to save the poor slave's feelings as much as possible, you should have the tower fitted up for two prisoners, in case I should decide to incarcerate with the slave the greatest and first of all human transgressors, the mother of mankind." He was referring to here to his sculpture, Eve Tempted, his first life-size ideal figure. While these negotiations were underway and slaves were being marched through the streets, the Greek Slave had moved from its first exhibition venue in New York City to the next display in Washington's downtown. Again, right across the street here where John Marshall Park is. In order to show off the sculpture to the Smithsonian regents he was courting, Kellogg would have had to lead them, the regents, across what is now the National Mall, and then across the fetid Washington City Canal, which is now Constitution Avenue. And I've shown the canal with a red line here. And then here is a photo of what the canal looked like. This is what one government report called, quote, that pestiferous ditch of water, end quote. From January 25th to March 25th, the Greek Slave was displayed inside the Odeon Theater at Pennsylvania Avenue and 4th Street, now the location of the Prettyman Federal Courthouse. You may recall that this was the precise location of Powers' studio 10 years earlier, or almost the precise location. By the 1840s, upscale residences, banks, churches, and civic buildings lined what became the city's downtown. The exhibition was open from 9 a.m. till 10 p.m. Admission was 25 cents, season tickets cost $1, and the aforementioned pamphlet was available for 12 and a half cents. Despite initial success and many distinguished admirers, from a full quorum of House and Senate, of the House and Senate to Dolly Madison and First Lady Sarah Polk, the Washington display was not the financial success Kellogg and Powers hoped it would be. One reason may have been the competition for entertainment dollars, most notably the popular tableau vivant, or displays of living statuary, as seen in the image at the lower right and mentioned in the news clipping at the upper right. But above the mention of living statuary, the text of this newspaper clipping reads, "The Greek Slave, this masterpiece of the age, is to be in this city in February next. We hope that Congress will instantly purchase it for the Capitol. It ought never to go out of Washington, and after it once gets here." I suspect this was Agent Minor Kellogg at work. At the precise moment that viewers were marveling at the Greek Slave in the Odeon Theater and Smithsonian negotiations continued across the canal, much was happening elsewhere in Washington that would determine the fate of the sculpture. Soon after having visited the Odeon to see the Greek Slave in March 1848, William Wilson Corcoran bought a home at the northeast corner of Connecticut and H Streets Northwest, directly and conveniently across Lafayette Park from the White House. Corcoran constantly courted the attention of presidents and congressmen, much as Powers had done during his time in Washington. That same year, you can see the location of what was Mr. Corcoran's house. It no longer stands. It is just across from the Hay Adams Hotel. That same year, 1848, getting my years confused, Corcoran sealed his banking fortune by selling government war bonds in European markets to finance the Mexican-American War. The sale established him as the leading international banker in this country and allowed him to retire from business in 1854. At that time, he increased his art collecting and philanthropic activities, which he had begun just a few years before. William Wilson Corcoran momentously unveiled his prized sculpture in his Washington mansion at his annual Christmas party in December 1851. The sculpture's new home was on its rotating pedestal in a semicircular skylit alcove, specially designed by none other than that busy architect, James Renwick. The alcove was located in the new west wing of the house, right here, I believe, specially commissioned to house Corcoran's nascent art collection, that is the whole west wing. This and the new east wing essentially turned the Federal-style house into an Italianate palazzo. The most celebrated sculpture in antebellum America attracted enormous publicity, ranging from shock at the figure's nudity to acclaim for Corcoran's reputation as a discerning collector. While we don't have a record of what Corcoran may have said or written about the Greek Slave, his intentions in purchasing the work probably centered around the sculpture's fame and the attention it would bring him. Corcoran had been a slaveholder, but in 1845 had freed his 35-year-old slave, Mary Neal, and her four children. He did not endorse the perpetuation of slavery, but upheld the right of the Southern states to secede. By 1855, Corcoran had opened the private picture gallery in his residence to the public for at least 2 days each week. Just 4 years later, it was time for yet another type of unveiling in his home. This would again signify the sculpture's tremendous significance to the collector, but also the central role it played in his personal life. In April 1859, his only daughter, Louise, at far left, named after his wife, Louise, who had died in 1841, married George Eustace Jr., a United States congressman from Louisiana, in the picture gallery of the Corcoran home. And the slide at the right, I think, is perhaps some later version or later photograph of the picture gallery. It's from about 1900, after Mr. Corcoran had passed away, which is to give you an idea of what the interior looked like. Louise married George Eustace in the picture gallery of the Corcoran home. The wedding was one of the last great social events of antebellum Washington. According to Harper's Weekly, the over 1,000 guests arriving for the evening nuptials were greeted by Mr. Corcoran. The house was lavishly decorated with flowers, quote, grouped in high pyramids, and myriads of wax lights added to the brilliancy, end quote. When it was time for the ceremony, Corcoran reappeared to lead guests into the picture gallery, where all were impressed by the beautiful, quote, beautiful tableau of the Greek Slave at one end in a bay window, which forms a fitting shrine, end quote. The sculpture, the Harper's writer continued, was, quote, an effective background for the bride, surrounded as it was by a cluster of scarlet azaleas and rare exotics, pure and white as the eloquent marble itself. While this role for the Greek Slave may at first seem unusual, as scholar Lauren Lessing suggests, notes, contemporary responses to the work combined with the mores of 19th century marriage suggest that the sculpture idealized Christian marriage by contrasting it with infidel decadence. It also expressed the pain felt by William Corcoran, a widowed father, and his only child contemplating their separation. Lessing further writes that wedding participants and guests, who would have seen the Greek slave again as the altarpiece for this wedding, quote, would not have seen the sculpture as a universal image of human bondage, but rather as a model of true womanhood, and by extension, a call for chivalrous male behavior, end quote. On January 1st, 1874, following the progress of our sculpture with this map, the Greek slave finally got her tower, the tribune that had been so desired in the Smithsonian building by Hiram Powers, his agent Minor Kellogg, and by the now very busy architect James Renwick. That date saw the opening of the first building to house the Corcoran Gallery of Art, not a 5-minute walk from Corcoran's home on Lafayette Square, and also, naturally, in immediate proximity to the White House. Renwick's octagonal gallery, directly over the front door of the museum, just here, which you can still see today, of course, was especially designed for the slave, which, in a sense, presided over the interior and the exterior of the building. In fact, this portrait of himself that Corcoran commissioned at about the time his museum opened tells all. It shows the proud founder standing in front of his new building with the Capitol seen over his left shoulder, Renwick Capitol. Those of you have probably figured out that it's not possible to view the two buildings in the background at the same time, demonstrating that Corcoran is strategically positioned between his new eponymous museum and the structure housing Congress, whose attention he constantly courted. In 1897, with the opening of the new Corcoran building designed by Ernest Flagg, the 520-pound sculpture was moved a few blocks south on 17th Street, where it remained on view in different locations for the next 117 years. In early 2015, soon after the closing of the Corcoran Gallery of Art, the sculpture made its way, with much of the rest of the Corcoran collection, to this institution, in effect coming full circle from where it had been first exhibited in 1848. Rather remarkable, I think. So where does all this leave us? The political positioning, slave markets, wedding altarpieces, and specially designed presentations and niches. Certainly the Greek slave has had a long, rich life of its own that many viewers have negotiated over time, to return to Carrie Mae Weems' words. While the sculpture may no longer be experienced in any of the 19th century contexts that we've considered this morning, it has a new 21st century context in the National Gallery of Art that will continue to evolve and to connect viewers to each other. On Saturday, January 20th of this year, I had the opportunity to contemplate this as I observed visitors in the gallery with the Greek slave. My photo is at the top right. That day, an unusual confluence of 5 events made for a very busy National Gallery of Art, with attendance of nearly 22,500 people in one day, compared to the average of 15,000 people on a typical January weekend day. It was the day of the 2018 Women's March, which reprised the historic 27 protest, the day after the March for Life, the first anniversary of the inauguration of this country's 45th president, the Saturday of the last weekend of the Vermeer and Masters of Genre Painting exhibition, and the day before a potential government shutdown. And it was 60 degrees. I could only speculate what was going through the minds of those I observed looking at the sculpture that day. Nuns, a priest, and others wearing their March for Life regalia, women in pink pussy hats, and other tourists. We may never know. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.